We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Welcome to the Extra Sauce Podcast.
It's my fancy sauce.
I want some fancy sauce.
Yeah.
I'm not done using it.
With the czar of sauces, Greg Hill.
Hello there, Mr. Shue.
Yes, hello, Mr. Hill.
Or don't say hey, 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 because that's what Bill Cosby says when he's coming out of court.
You know what gets me more than that is the people who are like egging him on.
I know. The
really?
Cosby fans.
Yeah.
They're egging him on.
Seriously.
Jeez. Welcome to this week's episode of Extra Sauce, and we're going to get some extra sauce this week on an interesting story from the news that we spoke about on the show this week. And 17 years ago, Molly Bish, a local high school girl, disappeared while lifeguarding in Warren, Massachusetts.
Yeah, I can't believe 17.
17 years.
Yeah.
17 years. Molly's body was later found in a wooded area, and Molly's mom had always reported seeing a suspicious individual in a white car when she had dropped Molly off for work as a lifeguard at Cummins Pond, the pond there in Warren.
Right.
This week, Molly's sister Heather has arranged ground radar to take a look at a campground to determine if that white car or another car is buried at that campground. And technology makes such a difference in this kind of thing, but
yeah,
that's something you couldn't have done that 17 years ago.
No,
I don't know.
No. The fact that there may be a car that's buried, that feat in itself, to me, is pretty incredible. I mean, think about the effort it takes to bury a car.
Yeah.
You know, and if this particular person, what they went through, you know, it was a campground, it's in the middle of nowhere, but still, you can't just go out there with a shovel, you know?
No. University of New Haven forensic science lecturer Peter Massey will use the ground penetrating radar in an effort to determine whether that car is buried in the campground, which is about 3 miles from Cummins Pond, where Molly disappeared. And Molly's sister, Heather, who has been conducting a keepers-like search for the killer of her sister, joins us now for a little extra sauce on Molly, her sister, and the search for who killed her.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate when that the media can continue to carry Molly's story and remind everybody that we are still looking for this person that took her on June 27th. 2000.
Well, you're kind, but we're not really legit media. I mean, let's be honest.
Yeah, true.
How
you are telling a story. I appreciate you telling the story.
Absolutely. How old were you when Molly disappeared?
I was 23.
23 years old, and
yep.
I think it's almost impossible for those of us who this hasn't happened to imagine how that remains on your mind as her sister forever. I mean, it is, and I am assuming that that's why you continue to pursue whoever did this to your sister.
Right. Well, you know, I don't know where you fall in the family tree, but being the oldest, you know, I was always very protective of my younger brother and sister. You know, if girls were calling Johnny and I wasn't, you know, thinking they were good enough for him, I would, you know, hang up the phone or you know, tell them not to call back in a very nice way.
Yeah.
but so I think just, you know, having sort of that, you know, feelings of protection, that this happened, I just can't really accept it. I can't accept that my sister was taken, you know, serving her community. She was a lifeguard. That will never be okay to me. Her shoes were left on the ground. I mean, to me, it's just, I can't, you know, I have to, you know, find balance. And actually right now I'm at my daughter's college orientation. So I'm not even actually at the research that's currently happening, but
yeah,
it's tricky. You know, you have to kind of find balance in your life and still sort of conduct normal life activities and work and take care of yourself and the people in your life. And then also sort of, you know, try to figure out how to find a murderer, which is not easy as an educator. I don't really, that whole law enforcement, criminal justice world is new and perplexing. And I certainly don't have the stomach for it.
Well, it's interesting to me in light of, we've been talking a lot about this Netflix documentary called The Keepers. I don't know if you've watched that or not, but
no.
And it's a good part of it is about a couple women who were, Catholic school students, and their favorite teacher, a nun, was murdered. And so they later on in life go on an investigation on their own and try to track down who's responsible. And so it's, I assume that you're kind of experiencing the same thing they do, where they start off and they don't really know how to investigate like a professional investigator, but they work their way through it.
And it's very similar to, I don't know if you know Melanie McLaughlin, who she did a documentary about Andy Pugliese, who disappeared out in the Boston area. I mean, it was Revere. I forget exactly where it was, but it was in the 70s. It was the projects, you know, and they didn't, you know, it was all botched. And this woman grew up, you know, in the projects, became a documentary filmmaker, did a film about Andy, which won an Emmy. Mm. And now she just graduated from Harvard with a master's degree. I mean, it's just, you know, it's amazing, but, you know, I do think you have to have a little bit of a social justice drive and, you know, sort of these feelings of trying to, you know, make sure that other people are safe and caring, you know, having a great deal of empathy. You know, I think that's what drives people to, you know, not just want to find the person that did this to Molly, but to make people aware that this happens. You know, every time I talk about Molly, I think of a case in Worcester where there was this girl who was the day before graduation taking public transportation home and then never came home. And so the family's looking for her, but, you know, a sort of a poor family from Worcester. And the brother goes out and finds her, ends up finding her dead, you know, and she had been killed by her own pocketbook, strangled. And I think about her, and I think about her family and how they didn't maybe have a voice. And so every time I speak for Molly or I do these things, it's not just for Molly. It's for all these cases that and their families who don't have the voice. I'm lucky. My parents, you know, sort of had this foundation and taught, you know, long before Molly disappeared, they were doing things to try to make the world better. I mean, my mom's a special ed teacher. My dad was a teacher and a probation officer. I mean, they had strong social justice philosophies. And, you know, so I think that, you know, being raised that way, that sort of is an internal drive.
It's haunting. I'm 50 years old, and I rode the bus to high school every day with a girl named Kathy Malcolmson, who, Kathy went on to, I assume, be abducted from my hometown of Stowe, and they've never found Kathy. So, and it's, you know, and the older I get, the more I think about it, you know, and I'm not family. I rode the bus with her and talked to her on the bus. I'm not family, but it's, what was Molly like?
Molly was a typical teenager. She was kind of the girl next door that everybody knew. She was silly. She loved to make people laugh. She kind of liked to be the class clown. She would be the one. She was an athlete. She played three sports, but she would be the one that was, you know, making faces during the slow part of the game or teasing somebody. She on the bench, you know, where she was always, you know, she kind of lit up a room with her sense of fun. My dad has this fifth grade sense of humor, and I think at least my sister and I inherited that a little bit. You know, we like pranking, we like, you know, silly humor. So she was like that, but she was very athletic. She played three sports. She trained all that year before to become a lifeguard. She loved kids. I had just had my daughter 11 months before Molly disappeared, and she was fantastic with Michaela. Her best friend lived across the street from, you know, the apartment I had with my then husband, and they came over all the time. And she was funny when she was little. You know, you're either like a stuffed animal kind of kid, or as a girl, or you're like a baby kind of doll kind of girl. And I always had animals. I was an animal person, horseback rider. But Molly was a baby. She loved dolls and babies, but she needed to have real baby clothes for her dolls, not just the dress-up clothes that you get at the, you know,
yeah,
Walmart or something.
So
she was, you know, she was very, you know, very real, you know, like I think that everyone can relate to Molly because she, you know, she was your best friend. She actually, after she disappeared, we found this out, but there was in her art class some special ed students that would be included and brought in, you know, for specials or whatever. And she would always write them notes. I'm so glad you're here. Or, hey, we're going to do this fun project today. I hope you'll help me do whatever. And I just think that she was really inclusive. She always like bounced around. She didn't have like a particular clique that she was a part of. She just, you know, she had a solid group of friends, but she also had this wide ranging, you know, she could fit in anywhere. So.
When your mom went to pick her up that day at the beach where she worked as a lifeguard, correct? And she was
to drop her off.
Her off. So she went to drop her off, and there was, your mom said, a man that was there in a white car, and that always was a bit of a clue with regard to Molly's disappearance, right?
So that was actually the day before Molly disappeared.
Okay.
My mom had dropped Molly off, and she saw this guy sitting in his car smoking a cigarette, and he was smoking like sort of in a lack of a better word, like a dainty kind of fashion,
yep,
not like a typical manly man smoking a cigarette. It was very dainty. So that she noticed. And then when she looked at him and she was like, what are you kind of doing here? My mom's a teacher and a very strong mother of being able to use guilt,
yeah,
to make you confess before, yeah, you know.
Yeah.
She's one of those. So she tried to give him that look, which generally works with her children and her students, but it didn't make any effect on him. So she got nervous, and she fumbled in her car a little bit and waited to see if he would leave, and he didn't. And so she decided she was going to get out and go sit with Molly for a little bit because it just gave her this uneasy feeling. So she did, and she just, you know, proceeded to talk to Molly about safety. And Molly said, Mom, it's okay. It's just fishermen here. And so sometimes that stays with me as a very pertinent piece of almost a clue, if you will, from Molly, because Cummins Pond is down a dead-end road in a very small town without cell service in the middle of Massachusetts, very rural area. Half the people in Warren don't go to Cummins Pond. It's, you know, moms who bring their kids there for swimming lessons, you know, maybe people in the area and people who fish. It's not really a well-known area. I mean, we never went there as kids to go swimming or anything or have picnics or anything like that. So, you know, it's that tells me behaviorally what kind of person is going to be, you know, around Molly to do her harm. And then, you know, when we think about where she was found, again, in the woods, where it's frequently hunting, up a mountain on a very steep incline, you know, a hunter, you know, founder, so it makes you think, you know, probably this person was familiar with the area and familiar with, you know, perhaps a hunter and a fisher.
We're getting extra sauce from you this week because of the tips that you received that this white vehicle may be buried underground. And are you working with a private investigator, and is that how these tips came to light?
Yeah, you know, it's funny how this all happened. When the foundation first began, our private investigator she's Molly's age. She was, you know, in college, so maybe your first year of college at American University in the D.C. area. And she was, you know, she was studying, I think, forensics or criminology. She's got a few degrees now, so I can't remember which degree exactly, but she, was doing a report on Molly's case and called my dad. And I don't know if he ever spoke to my dad, you know, before he had the stroke, but he's kind of a guy that would be like, yeah, come on up, come join me. I'm going to this national night out in Worcester. You want to come? We're doing a safety program. Come on.
We used to have your dad on the show frequently, and we did a bunch of events with him, and great, great guy.
So she came up and did that with dad, and then kind of started doing fundraising and working in the foundation with the ID kits and everything, and just kind of became a part of our sort of support network, and went on to receive her master's degree and her PhD and again in criminology and forensics. And she actually put herself through the police academy just because when she teaches at Fitchburg State, so she, you know, she wanted to know what her, you know, her students were going through. So she's very dynamic. But I really enjoy working with Farah because she provides a sort of psychological behavior kind of perspective and lens, if you will. And at this point in the investigation, that's kind of, you know, how we need to operate. And we know now, like when a kid goes missing, you know, they didn't really pay attention to that when Molly went missing. They immediately assumed she had drowned. And so they wasted precious, precious moments. I mean, we know that 76% of kids who are abducted by a stranger are murdered in the first 3 hours. Mm. So before they even started looking for Molly, she was probably already dead because they wasted so much time, you know, looking in the pond and saying she was off with her friends and not really taking it seriously. They had a real biasness because she was a teenager.
Is there a particular suspect that you feel most likely did this?
I wish I could say that there is. I wish that I had this like magical women's intuition, if you will, or something that told me. But we have a pool of some really strong suspects where we have so much circumstantial, you know, evidence, and we're just looking for that one piece. You know, we take a person and we build, and then we get so far, and then you just can't. You know, you can't get to that next, you know, step or level, if you will. And so you have to stop. And then you're, all right, let's go to this next guy. You know, we've got, you know, when we do these tip campaigns, we categorize all the information. So then we'll go to the next one. Okay, where does this lead us? And then, you know, that might lead us back to this person or whatever. And then we follow that through until we hit the end. And that's really all I can do. And taking these long shots, like we're doing today with this ground penetrating radar search. I mean, it's, you know, to me, it's just something. Why not? You know, or it's not disturbing the environment. It's not harming anything. It's just checking to see if anything's up there. It's ruling this out. Mm-hmm. And then, you know what, then we'll follow every other, you know, this was a few leads that we got in this particular person in this particular campground. And so we're just following it out. And if we don't get anything, then we stop and we go the next. So that's how we operate.
Is that person in jail or not?
No.
Not in
no.
jail.
Nope.
Okay.
So he's still in the area.
It's a particular tip about a person still in the area.
Yeah. We know areas.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. What's been the hardest part of this for you when it comes to the search for who killed Molly?
I think, you know, I lived in the world of education and working with kids, and so my experience with criminal justice was my dad telling maybe a funny story about a guy, you know, driving the wrong way and getting a DUI or something. Nothing as serious as a murder investigation. All I knew was, you know, what you see on TV. So that's what I assumed, and I think that's what most people assume. It's CSI, it's NCIS or whatever, and it is so not like that. You know, law enforcement agencies are, you know, like education, dependent on funding and resources and manpower. And when those things are cut, there's only so much you can do. But the other thing that, you know, that will surprise me about law enforcement, where, you know, coming from education, you know, if we have a complicated student, we're going to bring in the reading specialist, and we're going to maybe bring in a special ed teacher and maybe talk to a autism person or whatever, you know, to build this kid's, whatever the student needed, we'd build this individual program to support the student, you know? So again, that's my frame of experience and perspective. And so then you go to law enforcement and, you know, you can't get the FBI to work on a state police case unless they're invited by the state police. And the state police don't, you know, and then local police don't necessarily work with state police. And
yeah, yeah.
So it's this whole, like, nobody plays in the sandbox together. Mm. And God forbid you talk about an outside expert.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Right?
And it's like they work in these silos. So for me, that was like, what are you guys doing? I can't understand this. This is like Mars to me. And I don't understand how this serves anybody to the best practice or ability.
Right.
So I think, you know, and because Dad, you know, had relationships with law enforcement as a probation officer, it worked for a while. And then he had the stroke. And then I sort of became the investigative or the lead person in the family dealing with investigative stuff. And my frame of reference was different. And so for me personally, it was trying to understand and come to a place with our law enforcement team and how we can work together, because I'm not ever going to be that person that sits on the sidelines quietly, you know, and watches,
I can tell.
And waiting for someone else to do something.
Yeah.
I am like, I'll go do it and apologize after, you know.
Have you?
I just can't.
Have you had a moment where you've had to confront any of these suspects, or a scary moment yet?
Oh yeah, tons. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And even, you know, people like the Tim McGuigans of the world who quote unquote found the bathing suit, but also became a person of interest because of the peculiar behavior and, you know, around him. So, you know, he and having, you know, being in a small town and running into him at a restaurant or, and just, you know, those kinds of things. You know, I wouldn't say that, you know, anyone's been, you know, necessarily threatening or anything. I think the interesting part, I think, that my brother and I experienced differently than my parents were that, and this is a whole, you know, sibling thing. And actually, John and I work with the National Center and a lot of different nonprofits across the country and other siblings, because prior to Molly disappearing, there was no resources for siblings of missing and murdered children. And so there was like the parents would call the parents, and John and I would be like, what happens to the kids? We didn't even meet Holly Prayan's brother.
Yeah.
And that's like our neighbor, you know?
Yeah.
So it was a struggle for us. And finally, you know, the National Center, and they organized, we did a book with them and we did a movie, and I'm actually going down to Texas to work with the Laura Recovery Center, which is a nonprofit, and they're making this whole YouTube series, which is cool because there's actually a lot of siblings out there that are willing to talk about this whole experience. And I think for me, the biggest healing, everything that I've done, you know, the therapy, the EMDR, the shame in visits, whatever, I've tried everything to feel better about, you know, everything, or at peace or something. But I think meeting someone who's gone through the same thing and it, you know, having to like sort of be that, like I said, living the sort of double life where you're doing an interview, but you're at your daughter's college orientation, or you're,
right,
you know, trying to work, but you're also, as I'm working, I'm calling my PI to see if we can, you know, how to organize a search. You know, it's kind of like this crazy double life you live.
Are you getting a lot of information that maybe the state police aren't getting or turning away or something like that?
Well, you know what I think, you know, and I can't speak to how they, you know, that would be a question for them to how they take their leads. But what my understanding is that they, you know, they record the leads or whatever they are. And if they don't match up with what they know, they don't necessarily follow it. So that was one of the things that, you know, caused a great deal of anxiety to me for many years, because I didn't really understand that. And I was like, oh my God, you know, these people would say, I turned in this lead and I the police never came and interviewed me. And I'm like, what do you mean?
Yeah.
And so that's when I was like, oh my God, I gotta start recording this stuff. I mean, I was starting to become like, I don't know if you've ever watched that, oh God, I can't think of it right now, but she does these like lines on her walls, like matching people. And so I was really, I mean,
oh, it's
I
home,
really
you're talking about Homeland. You're talking about Homeland.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
I was like getting crazy like that. I felt like, cause I'm like, this person, you know, knew this person, and
yeah,
I know they were buying drugs here. And like, you know, cause generally, you know, that these people like kind of hang around with the same people because
right.
they're drinking and they're beating women and they're drugging and they're, you know, they're not engaging in the highest levels of behavior, you know.
Do you think
but
that
anyway.
you mentioned Holly Pranian. What do you think the likelihood is that the same person that killed Molly was responsible for Holly?
I mean, I think it's possible. The likelihood, I don't think so. I mean, if it was like a sexual crime, usually they have a certain type. If it was just that, you know, they like young blonde girls, possibly.
Yeah.
But I think they kind of have a good idea in Holly's case.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that our investigators talk. They certainly share new information that they get. But I don't think anything's ever connected in a way that we ever like thought like more than 50% or 25%.
We admire your dedication to trying to find your sister's killer, and it's something that those of us who are parents and those of us who are siblings hope that we never ever have to go through, and you are, I'm sure, doing the work that will hopefully lead to some closure for you and the family.
Yeah.
And so,
well, you know, I think the progress that you know, I'm hopeful about, if nothing else happens today, two things. You know, perhaps we'll get more leads on this person in this general area that will lead us to the next, you know, place that we'll go or thing to look at. But also, after all that, you know, time and, you know, what I was talking about with law enforcement, we finally come to the place in the last year or so, I'd say, where we're kind of supporting and respecting each other. You know, they're kind of, in some levels and ways, explaining to me, you know, how and why they're tied to what they're doing, and sort of not, I want to say, getting mad, but they're sort of respecting and understanding and supporting the things that I need to do.
Mm.
Where, you know, where I might, you know, conduct a campaign, tip campaign, or I might have a search or something. For example, today they're going to be up there, which is a huge step for me,
mm-hmm.
that they're showing that they're supporting us. And I think if they're, you know, that sets a precedent. We need to support victim families. You know, if they want to dig up a grave and have something tested, if they want to, you know, we need to listen to them, we need to respect them, and we need to support, you know, their own efforts, I think.
Well, Heather, thank you so much for joining us and telling Molly's story on Extra Sauce.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you calling, and I appreciate you sharing the story.
Always amazed by how strong people are who go through something like that and are able to keep that search going day after day, and year after year, 17 years ago.
And like she said, and having a life, you know, having kids of her own.
Yes.
And family and a job and everything. And she said the balance.
Yeah.
You know, for doing it that long. And she's obviously never going to stop.
No.
Ever.
No.
Yeah.
Well, the search continues. And if you are somebody who has any information, you can contact the Bish Foundation.
Right.
And oftentimes something that you think is not a clue ends up being a very important clue. So
even though it was
17 years ago, there may be relevant information that you have. And if so, I'm sure that Heather would like to hear about it.
And like she said, whether it's this case or any case, you gotta tell somebody.
Yes.
You know, you got to help these people.
Yeah, well, and the cooperation thing is interesting. I think it's very tough for the family of victims to not understand why the amount of effort that's being put in, or to be critical of the amount of effort that's being put in. But there are so many cases and so many different law enforcement agencies. So it's but you can understand her frustration.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you hear her. So. Our thanks to Heather Bish for joining us for a little extra sauce on that radar penetrating or that ground penetrating radar search this week. We will be back next week with another episode of Extra Sauce. Subscribe. at iTunes or Google Play or Stitcher. And we'll talk with you next week.
Oh, please. Give us a good rating,
You're
too.
Always begging for
please.
Ratings.
I'll get on my knees, but then I won't be able to speak into the microphone.
For you, it's just
please.
About the ratings.
We're doing it for the ratings. Right. And you know, if you don't like us, you get your money back.
That's true. That's true. We do have a money-back guarantee because right. it costs you absolutely freaking nothing to hear this podcast. So thanks a lot for listening.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.